Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. A lot has changed since we released our Global Communications Report on New Activism back in April. We knew that corporate and brand activism was going to be a major topic in our industry this year, but we could have never predicted just how important it would be in these unprecedented times. In this first season of PR Future, we've heard from prominent activists and PR professionals who are navigating powerful social movements, political crises, and the pandemic in real time. And we've learned from them about their amazing work focused on making the world a better place. We interviewed several activists who were engaged in a variety of issues, including diversity, gun control, climate change, and voting. We also spoke to communications leaders at activist corporations, including P&G, Ben & Jerry's, and Levi's. Each of our guests has provided unique insights on a variety of topics surrounding new activism. We've learned how to form effective partnerships, how to learn from an organization's fandoms. We've discovered the power of social media in starting movements, and how to earn profits through principles. So we wanted to take some time in this season finale to look back at what we've learned from our guests in the past 6 months. In the context of our earlier research, it seems to ring true now more than ever. This time, I'm your guest and your host, Fred Cook, and this is PR Future. Let's start by defining new activism. We asked PR professionals and activists whether activism has grown over the last 5 years, and two-thirds of them said yes. Two-thirds also said that activism was going to continue to grow in the coming 5 years. And the main reason they cited for that growth was, number one, a declining trust in political institutions, and also a lack of government action. These are the factors that are causing corporations and activist groups to step up their efforts. Brendan Duff of March for Our Lives said it best.
Scheduling, helping with doing the interviews themselves, of alumni in this group too, and we were very conscious to not be in the interviews and not be doing the interview. Students and people that had really just witnessed and could act about this trauma in front of cameras, because we didn't face, but it was completely raw, completely organic.
Well, PR professionals recognize that activism is growing. They mainly see activists as antagonists rather than allies. When we asked them about the effectiveness of activism, many claimed that activists were good at raising awareness of social issues, but not very good at achieving long-lasting change. And activists tend to agree, but we could see in all of our conversations and our survey that activists today, the new activists, are looking for long-lasting change and real results of their efforts. But who are these new activists? We asked the communications community what they thought, and they said that they were younger, more likely urban, more likely female, more educated, and very tech savvy. And Kelly McGinnis, who heads up communications at Levi's, agrees.
Certainly for us, from a community perspective and sort of the consumers that we are trying to attract, they're absolutely younger, they're more global, and they have a global perspective. One of the things that I think is fascinating is our US Instagram handle is followed around the world. The vast, vast majority of the folks who are following that are following it from outside the United States. And so they're absolutely connected online. They're socially aware and they hold us accountable. And what we hear from them is they want to be a part of companies and efforts that are making things better.
And when we ask both PR professionals and activists who were the most influential people in creating societal change, and they agree that it is the average citizen, community leaders, the everyday people who have access to the internet and very powerful tools to deliver their message. Secondly, they both agreed that celebrities had a lot of influence on social issues. And one group, Rock the Vote, has always used celebrities as spokespeople. And Carolyn DeWitt, the president, explains why they are so important to that organization.
They have incredible platforms, especially when we think about their reach on social media. In some cases, certain influencers will also have specific experience or a specific aspect of voting or democracy that they bring to the table. Snoop Dogg, for those who don't know him as Snoop, you know, he's going to be voting for the first time ever because he's a returning citizen and he always thought that he was ineligible to vote. And so there's a lot of education that can be done around, you know, making sure that people understand, even if they've been told they don't have the right to vote, to double check that because that may not actually be the case.
Both groups also rank CEOs as the fourth most influential group, way above politicians and religious leaders. One of the major shifts we saw in our research and in our conversation with activists is the move from protesting to policymaking. The new activists have realized that protesting in the streets does raise awareness, but the key to long-lasting change is engagement in the political process. March for Our Lives is a great example. They started as a march on Washington, D.C., and then shifted their strategy to register young people to vote for the causes they believed in. And Brendan Duff explains why.
We wanted to raise awareness so that there was enough public will and political will and enough public opinion on one side of this to be able to affect these policy points. We saw the step one as being the march, and that's kind of the springboard for this amazing large youth voter turnout that we wanted to enact in the midterm election just a few months down the road later that year in 2018.
We also discovered that the new activist is very media savvy. Like PR professionals, they're using a variety of channels to deliver their message. Foremost is social media. And April Rain explained how Twitter in particular was so powerful in getting the word out about Oscar So White.
I tweeted one thing, Oscar So White, they asked to touch my hair. And that was it. And then when I checked in on Twitter around lunchtime, the hashtag based on that one tweet was trending internationally. And Twitter tells me that between that day in January and the actual Oscars telecast about 6 weeks later, the hashtag OscarSoWhite was used around the world over 600,000 times based on that one tweet. I think each social media platform does different things well. You know, Instagram is a visual platform. This was not a visual issue. You know, I can put up a picture of 20 white faces to say, well, you know, here are the nominees. You know, what's wrong with this picture? Why aren't there any people of color? But you can't really have a back and forth conversation and really discuss those issues on Instagram, or at least I can't, the way that I can on Twitter.
But they're not just focused on social media. They're using a variety of traditional media channels to get the message out and to create change, as Brendan Duff explains.
You know, you have to remind yourself frequently that Twitter and social media does not represent real population and real public opinion. So that's where I think that you're seeing so much information from activists come in about things like traditional strategies like billboards and books and other means of reaching people, because I think activists are really starting to get attuned to the idea that Twitter does not represent America or the world. And there are other ways to kind of break through that echo chamber to still reach people.
And in this age of TikTok, Jamie Margolin, the 18-year-old founder of Zero Hour, wrote a book. But her book isn't about climate change. It's about public relations and how any activist can use media to tell their story.
When I first got involved in activism, there was really no guide or anything. I just felt lost. I was just stepping into this abyss of just so many different things, and I needed something to help me, you know, really get into this. And so I decided, you know, I'm going to write the book that I always wished I would have had, like a guide to being a young activist and organizer. I'm going to write that book. And so I did.
During our research, we discovered that new activists are not only different demographically than their predecessors, they also communicate differently and have different goals. And all of this requires that those of us in the communications business also adopt new strategies and new responses. About 1/4 of PR professionals consider themselves to be activists, But when you ask the communications professionals at these activist organizations how they classify themselves, most would say that they're allies, that they're people who support activists and activist causes. Damon Jones at Procter & Gamble explains it this way.
You know, I've never really used the word activist to describe myself. I mean, I do describe myself as an advocate. First and foremost, you know, I want our company to be one of the most in-touch companies in the world. And we know our consumers are increasingly more diverse in any number of areas. You know, what is smart from an advocacy standpoint is smart from a business standpoint.
And Kelly McGinnis at Levi's agrees.
I don't know that we call ourselves activists, but we certainly feel like advocates, and we want to hear and try to create an environment where people's voices can be heard.
But companies like Procter & Gamble and Levi's are really outliers with their relationships with activist groups. While most communicators said they consider the reaction of activist groups when they're formulating new policies and programs, not very many of them engage activists in the overall process. April Rain, who called out the Academy Awards for being Oscar so white 5 years ago and brought this to national attention, has actually never been contacted by the Academy herself.
You know, I did attend the Oscars last year in 2019, but now 5 years, going on year six of Oscar so white, the Academy has never reached out to me to have conversations about inclusion and representation of traditionally underrepresented folks in front of and behind the camera. You know, I get called into casting agencies. You know, they're, oh, well, absolutely, we get it. We need more actresses of color and we need more disabled actors and so on and so forth. And I say to them, where are you going to find them? You know, because as I walk through your halls to get to this beautiful conference room, you know, the people sitting at the desks and in the offices are not diverse. And so what network are you going to use now to find those traditionally underrepresented folks when you have not been able to do so for as long as you've been in business? You know, so it's not just the face, you know, literally sometimes that you're putting on a product or in front of a camera, whatever the case may be. It's also the recruitment and retention of qualified individuals from diverse backgrounds that are working behind the scenes. And I think that's why, you know, that people don't like to speak to advocates and activists on these issues, because we will call them to task. I mean, that's kind of our job, and people don't want to have to deal with their own reflections.
But our research showed that the majority of companies that do work with activists find that those relationships are very beneficial to their brand. Levi's has a history of working with activists and find that it's core to who they are as a company.
It just takes like one little scratch of investigation to get an appreciation for how important the values of the company are and its historical focus on what we call profits through principles, which means that every decision that we make throughout the company starts from a place of really thinking about those values and are we doing right by the communities that we serve. I don't think that from the outside you really fully appreciate how inherent it is to the company's DNA until you become a part of it. One, when you come to employee orientation, people show up with such incredible high expectations around our values. And I find as the person leading internal communications in particular, we have to live up to those expectations and it really pushes you. And then externally, our reputation is so strong, you feel like you're a steward of something that's much bigger than the tenure of any one leadership team.
And Rock the Vote, which has been around for quite a long time, also has a whole variety of corporate partners who help them deliver their message to young people across the country.
We probably have now, I would say, almost 36 brands we're working with, maybe more. You know, we've had a long-standing partnership with HBO, with Levi's. We just announced a new partnership with Sony and with Nike, PopSockets, Zumiez, which is another retailer. Warner Media, actually our partnership from HBO grew into a Warner Media partnership. So all of our partnerships start with kind of the idea of the brand, the company is you know, stepping up and saying that we want to create a culture of civic engagement for our employees or for our customers or both. And so a lot of times we'll work with the brand side, the public marketing side, but in some cases we'll also be working with the corporate social responsibility or the HR team, depending on the company and its goals.
About two-thirds of the communicators we spoke to confessed that their companies or their clients were not very prepared to deal with activist issues or activist groups. But there was one company that's been prepared for a long time, and that's Ben & Jerry's, who bases their whole corporate philosophy on activism. And they've even created a department of activism run by Chris Miller, who's been with the company for the last 7 years.
At Ben & Jerry's, my sole role was to develop and build activism campaigns, both in the US, and we now have staff in 7 countries around the world who do this work. And so I lead a global team of essentially campaigners that work within the context of this for-profit ice cream company. There's sort of a famous quote that Ben has that the strongest bonds that you can create with your customers is around a shared set of values. And so I think what we understand is that this work does build strong connections with our consumers. It makes our fans and customers much more likely to be loyal to our brand, less likely to, you know, trade us for Haagen-Dazs when they're on sale. Having said that, we never, ever think about that when we're designing the work that we do. So we contrast our approach to what would be a typical cause-related marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. And that's, if I'm honest, that's what most corporations, how they sort of move around in this space. And how that typically works is the brand will identify their consumer base. They will look for a issue or cause that resonates with their consumer base. And then they'll build a campaign around that to emotionally connect with that consumer base around that entry. In our case, we always start not with what is our consumer and what do they care about. We start with what are our values? What do we care about? What's the change we seek to make in the world? And then we want to design campaigns that emotionally connect with our consumer base so that they join us in taking action to make change in the world.
Like Ben and Jerry's, many organizations have realized that there is power in purpose and that doing the right thing can be good for business. One of those companies is Procter & Gamble. And Damon Jones explains why purpose is so important to profits.
We make no apologies that doing the right thing for society is in fact the right thing to do for business. You know, a rising tide lifts all boats, and we like that since we're the people that make tide. When you have a more well-represented set of people behind the camera, in the case of advertising, you get better stories in front of the camera, right? So a lot of what we're doing is trying to say, okay, great, let's change the ecosystem in the industry in which we're participating in to therefore change the output. You can see similar thing in terms of our supplier diversity efforts, right? If we really want greater economic equality, we need to be buying from more small businesses. We need to be buying from more minority and women-owned businesses.
Our research found that only 28% felt that corporations should take a public stand on issues unrelated to their business. But P&G is one organization that is willing to tackle the most sensitive topics.
A couple of years ago, we launched a video called The Talk. And The Talk was a video that basically told the story of how a mother, in this case a Black mother, was having conversations with her children about the realities of racism in the world, right? And when we ran that video, we got a couple of different reactions. There was a large group of consumers that said, hey, that's a great video. Thank you. That's my life. I can really understand and relate to that. There was another group of consumers who reacted to that and said, oh, wow, never really recognized that that was a dynamic that was at play. And there was a third group of consumers that said, wait a minute, P&G, you know, you don't have a right to play in that conversation. And they accused us of race baiting in so many different words, right? And so, you know, that was a moment of truth. And we stepped back and we said, okay, wait a minute, you know, these, and this is a company that, you know, we like to keep people happy, right? Who do we ever want to be mad at Tide as a brand? But we recognize that this was an important conversation that needed to happen when you take into context everything that was happening in the U.S. at the time. You know, race has always been a difficult issue for us to talk about. But our belief is if we can find constructive ways to have that conversation, then we can bring people together. And we can't get to a better place in this country until we're able to talk about it.
In the past, a company's CEO has been the decision maker on which issues the company should take a stand upon. But more and more, we're seeing employees influence those decisions. And Levi's is a great example of the employee's voice driving their societal efforts.
Almost every one of the very pioneering decisions that we've taken ahead of our time have been first and foremost initiated by our employees. Bob Haas was the CEO back in the 80s, and you ask, how did you find yourself on the front lines of the AIDS epidemic and the only corporate leader who was out? You know, he was in the lobby handing out condoms. And he says, I was there because our employees told me I needed to lend a voice and I needed to make a difference. And if you follow that red thread for each one of these examples, that's where it starts. And we're most authentic and we have the strongest voice when our employees knock on the door and say, how are we going to make a difference in this area? And that's been the case time and time again on the issues that matter to us and where we've been able to make a big difference.
In January, when we asked communicators what type of organizations they were willing to stand with, most picked non-controversial groups like the World Wildlife Fund or the Humane Society. Only 19% mentioned Black Lives Matter, and 24% said none of the above. But that figure has changed. This summer, we saw an overwhelming outpouring of support from corporate America for Black Lives Matter. And I think we're going to see that increasing in the future as we see companies feeling more and more pressure from consumers, from employees, and from activist groups to get involved with issues that in the past they never considered as possibilities. And once again, Ben and Jerry's led the way with their statement about dismantling white supremacy, which was lauded as one of the most powerful statements on the topic of racial injustice from any company.
We were pretty clear both about the language, but as you may know, we also highlighted four policy-based solutions Yes. that we believe begin to move us, you know, in the right direction. And so the other important part of this process was sharing the statement with our nonprofit civil society partners. We want to make sure that we get eyes on it from people who are on the front lines of this stuff so that what we're doing is seen as being in service of those on the front lines. And that's a critical element of how a statement like this for us comes together. It was by far the biggest thing that Ben and Jerry's has ever done on an order of magnitude. It had over 3 billion impressions, Wow. which is just mind-blowing.
Despite the acknowledgement that activism is growing in importance and influence, only 11% of the communicators we interviewed in January said that they plan to engage with an activist group in the coming year. Why is that number so low? Damon Jones has the answer.
I think for those that don't actively engage, not only does it sometimes come from a fear, but it sometimes comes from a place of thinking that you have to be perfect to engage, right? When you take an issue such as race or gender, and we have, you know, very broad aspirations to be 50-50 men and women at every management level in our company. And, you know, right now we're at 48, right? But we're not going to let being at 48 and not yet being to 50 stop us from being a vocal advocate of gender equality. We've got some gaps in racial representation in our company. That doesn't stop us from advocating for the right things from a race relations perspective. So I think there's a degree of humility that's important in that consideration. But it's also, you know, what I would say is when we sit down and try to have these conversations, our goal is not to prove that we are right or that we are good or that we're better, but to really share our commitment that we want to be better than where we are today, right? And that we actually need different points of view and different people to help us get there.
Probably the most important finding of our study was about the future and the opportunity for activists and corporate communicators to work more closely together. While their perceptions of each other may be a little off, there's a lot of common ground that they share in terms of the causes they support, the methods that they use to communicate, and their commitment to the political process as the way to create long-lasting change. And Brendan Duff sums it up very nicely.
Activism, again, it's not just the people that are rallying in the streets and protesting every day. You know, a lot of activists are on the other side of this and are working for PR firms or are working for big corporations, and they consider themselves activists and advocates too. And oftentimes they're within the organization. So that's signifying how it's going to be a much more singular lane, like the activism lane and the PR corporate lane right now, are going to start merging more together and strategies are going to start coinciding. But I don't think we're quite there yet.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the first season of PR Future. I hope, like us, you learned a little bit about new activism and its impact on the world of public relations. If you want to learn more, you can tap the link in show notes and download your copy of New Activism. And you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. To stay in the loop about our upcoming season, follow us on social media. See you all soon, and fight on. Today's episode was produced and recorded remotely in Los Angeles by Ron Antoinette and Zazu Lippert from the USC Center for Public Relations. And I'm your host, Fred Cook, and this is PR Future.